Welcome to Crash Concepts, where the economy, energy, and the environment are explored. Up next, fresh ideas and insights into the factors that are driving the world and shaping your future. Presenting information you can't afford to live without, here's Chris Martinson.
Welcome to this Peak Prosperity Podcast. I am your host, Chris Martinson, and today is May 16th, 2017. Now, I have the pleasure today of speaking once again with Joel Salatin, one of the most visible and influential leaders in the organic food and sustainable farming movement. His family owns and manages Polyface Farms, which is featured prominently in such modern food movement masterworks as The Omnivore's Dilemma by Michael Pollan, in the documentaries Fresh and Food Inc., American Meat, and most recently, the documentary Polyfaces. And of course, he has a blurb on the back of our latest book, Prosper. Hey, look, I can't wait to get started, as the conversation is always lively, it's always informative, it's sure to arouse both curiosity, maybe a slight whiff of alarm. Hey, you'll laugh, you'll cry, and you'll suddenly develop a new interest in space colonization. Joel, welcome back.
Thank you. It's great to be with you, Chris. Well, you know, I really live out here in the country, and, you know, lots of forests and stuff around. I'm not sure that I've noticed a decline too much. There certainly does seem to be a decline in birds, which of course would you know, mirror a decline in insects. I know that on our farm, we're just entering our third year on a Smithsonian benchmark study where they're actually measuring not all insects, but pollinators and birds. And you know, what's great for us to know is that we are way up of all the sites that they're looking at. We're in the top with the number of pollinators. All 8 species of bumblebees in Virginia are here on our little farm. So you know, our position has always been that, you know, good farming should actually increase wildlife, which includes everything from earthworms to pollinators to spiders to insects. And certainly, you know, when you have, you know, pretty much indiscriminate policies of spraying and policies of mono speciation, it's not very conducive to diversified insects.
Well, yes, and I, you know, maybe you're in a slightly different position there, given your surrounds. You know, a lot of my experience in tracking the insect populations comes from these long drives that my family has done every year I've been alive. We go to upstate New York. It's about a 6-hour drive. It's through, you know, bucolic, picturesque farm country. And this is all mostly corn and some soybean farming and whatnot. And these are the people, I think, who are really heavily using neonicotinoids, GMO, all sorts of things. Like they're using, it looks really bucolic and all that, but really this is the center of the agricultural revolution, as it were, and they're really hammering away. So I'm pretty sure that has a lot to do with it.
Oh, absolutely. Well, the fact is that a landscape that is extremely simplistic, you know, in speciation, whether it's animals or plants or whatever, but an environment that is highly simplistic is not very conducive, you know, to wildlife and to, you know, at least to a broad array of wildlife, which includes everything from, you know, of course, deer all the way down to whatever. It is conducive a lot of times to pathogens, mm-hmm. You know, molds, viruses, and even vermin, you know, whether it's rats, mice, raccoons, possums, you know, those sorts of things that are kind of the, you know, the lower end. I realize that wildlife centers, you know, take these critters in and nurse them back to health and protect them. But around here, they're considered vermin, and we they don't last long when they encounter. I mean, we don't go out and try to exterminate them, but, you know, when you find a possum in the chicks or in the egg nest box, that possum is not a friend.
So you take them out back and you have a conversation with them. Is that correct?
We do. We have a conversation.
Yes.
Yeah, it's a very loud report.
Yeah, and so I sure get that, and I've had a few conversations here. Woodchucks, I found you. There's just really no talking to a woodchuck. They are just
no talking to a woodchuck. No, they're just evil. Yeah, they're a real problem.
They just
there's some things that I just don't know what they were made for, but I guess everything has a purpose, but I haven't discovered it on a few things. I mean, the fact, again, we don't try to eradicate. We don't set traps out and try to kill everything. But we try to provide a great habitat, lots of moles and voles and things, and diversity for stuff to eat. And if they can't be satisfied with that, then we assume that there's an overpopulation. And we don't need dependent vermin.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that groundhogs are here to teach us both hopelessness and patience as gardeners. I think that's probably where they fit in. They're like bulldozers. Astonishing how much they can eat.
Yeah, they can move an astonishing amount of dirt, that's for sure.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. All right, well, so last time we talked, you know, you were in the process of finishing up your latest book, The Marvelous Pigness of Pigs. You had a bit of curiosity about how that was going to be received because of its subject matter. So how has it and how is it being received?
Yeah, well, it's the short answer is pretty mixed. The folks who have read it, generally, the people who have read it love it. I mean, love it. I've had, I think, more letters from people thanking me for, I've wanted to say this all my life, and finally somebody's verbalized it, and blah blah blah, than anything I've ever done. But it's been a hard sell and hasn't sold like, I hoped. Not that I write for, I don't write stuff to sell, but it's always nice to make some sales if you can. And the most telling thing about it was that Faith Words, who published it, went to 150 pastors around the country for a cover blurb, and for the first time in history, they could not get a single response. And the reason was because the pastors were scared of the congregation. You know, what do you do if you're a pastor and you put a little, you ought to read this, just all you got to do is say you got to read this book, on the back cover, and your choir director, has a daughter that's just become a research assistant at Monsanto, and she's all giddy about daughter landing this nice high-paying job in corporate America. Or what do you do, if your head elder has two Tyson chicken houses? And so this really struck into that tension that I speak about in the book and address this tension in the faith community that is. It's Chick-fil-A, and it's cheap food and junk food, and that leaves me enough money to put in a missionary barrel, and it's a real tension in the faith community. Interestingly, I've had probably as much positive response from the total non-faith community saying, man, I'm going to get three of these and give them to my three, Christian friends, and they need to read this. that's been pretty positive. But it was just released this week in paperback, and I just think it hasn't gotten traction, partly because the faith community isn't quite sure what to do with it. They have their youth night and bring in Papa John's pizza and Coca-Cola, and that's what the youth eat and drink at their youth parties all the time. And this book dares to question whether that's the right thing we should do with God's stuff.
Well, and that's an interesting proposition, of course, and it means a belief system. It's, to give up the Papa John's and the soda, I don't think, there's a variety of reasons you might do that. But one of the first things you have to confront is a very dark idea, which is that corporations may not, may not have your best interests at heart.
Yes, and not even your best interests, but the interests of
anything,
you know, of a divine, of God, who we, as Christians, we say, I realize that many of your listeners are not Christians, but in the faith community, we say, you know, the earth is the Lord's and the fullness thereof, and that's what the Bible says. It's all His. And you know, to question, well, what's His return on investment? You know, is it a good return on His investment of creation that we have a dead zone the size of New Jersey in the Gulf of Mexico from farm chemical runoff? You know, if the earth were your stuff, you know, how would you like somebody treating it that way? You know, and the question, the theme of the book is, you know, is what you say you believe in the pew showing up on the menu?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I realize that there's hardly anybody writing. I mean, there are plenty of theologians. It's fine for a theologian to write about stewardship, and you know, it's kind of abstract. Yes, we should take care of things and all that. You know, everybody, yes, amen. You know, it's all nice and focus group academic. But as soon as you start actually becoming practical with it, that's where it kind of gets dicey. I mean, you know, one of my favorite passages in there is when I say, you know, why can't a youth group leader, instead of taking the kids to, you know, Six Flags over Georgia or whatever, to the resort, and all, why don't they buy a bunch of mattocks and go to the local farmer that's got thistles and weeds and a multiflora rose and chop brambles for a day and kind of help restore some order there and learn what you know, what thorns and brambles and the sweat of your brow is all about, you know, so that when you come to you know, that brambles and thorns and weeds and all that stuff came as a result of sin. Well, you know, it's a metaphor for sin, you know, it takes work to attack them, you know, and then you have this, the other theme of the book is that the physical world we live in, that our day-to-day visceral world is an object lesson of spiritual truth. And so how we handle the practical, visceral, living day to day, is how we actually, you know, invoke or embrace or illustrate, you know, faith and love and mercy and beauty and neighborliness and all those kinds of things. You know, it's not very neighborly to have a manure lagoon that stinks up the neighborhood, pollutes all the water, and gives everybody nausea. You know, that's not very neighborly, the golden rule, you know, doing to others as you would want them to do unto you. You know, most of industrial agriculture is located, you know, in poor communities or faraway communities, because they're not very neighbor friendly. And so what, you know, what does that say about any kind of business when nobody wants to live next to it? You know, we think that good farming should be aesthetically and aromatically, sensually romantic, so much so that neighbors want to live next to it. And I mean, that's the principle of the golden rule. So, you know, there's a lot of you know, practical applications in the book, and I think that's why it's a tough read, you know. But but a lot of people have been very positive about, you know, who really respond and enjoy the fact that, you know, this guy's not just off on some, you know, pulpit being academic. It's actually daring to ask the question, you know, how shall we then live? But I've had some interesting response. I'll be doing my first big you know, church presentation in Indianapolis about the book. They're actually buying 100 copies, using it as a study book, and then I'm coming to do a weekend of seminars for this. It's kind of a three church. The three of them are going together, and so I'm really excited about that. And I presented a couple of months ago at the Progressive Youth Ministers Conference in Montreat, North Carolina, and that was kind of cool. So Yeah, it's a, you know, it's a topic worth wrestling over, and I certainly don't purport to have all the answers, and I don't want to start a cult. And I say in the book, you know, look, I don't think there's anything wrong at all with eating a Snickers bar. I'm not gonna tell you that you're in sin if you eat a Snickers bar. But I would dare to question whether you should eat a Snickers bar every day. All right. I mean, there's a balance there. And that's what we're after.
Yeah, a lot of fascinating things to pick up on there. And one of them, I was quite intrigued to learn that the word sin, its root meaning translates to miss the mark. And so to sin was to like shoot an arrow and you know, went wide or something like that. It's literally to right. miss the mark. And so you were talking about the brambles and the thorns and all of that. And if you've got those taking over your farm, I suggest, you know, you're missing the mark, in some way, shape or form there. Right. And this is, I think what you're getting to is this idea that in many respects, you know, we've defaulted. We've gone down the easy route. It's real easy to buy that Snickers bar every day. It's real easy to get the Papa John's and the soda, not to pick on those two things. I mean, I could pick anything, mm-hmm. but when you have that every single day, you clearly miss the mark, and we can detect that in all of our base statistics about the metabolic syndromes and the obesity and the levels of unhappiness. If we believe there's any correlation between what we eat and how we feel and on and on and on, we're clearly missing the mark in lots of ways. And so what you've done here is you've tied it back and you've given people of faith, of Christian faith, a way to begin to connect those dots. Is that right?
Yeah, that's exactly right. And, you know, it's a concern to me when the faith community, which is supposed to demonstrate a lot of really positive things, you know, greater order and greater function in their lives, whether it's happier marriages, happier kids, you know, and I'm not a big, you know, health, wealth preacher, you know, name it, claim it kind of guy. There's certainly things that you can't help. But in general, the faith community is called to be, you know, an example of positive alternative in a dysfunctional world. And, you know, it's concerning when we have the same level of obesity and all these lifestyle diseases. You know, 80% it's huge, of our diseases and sicknesses are lifestyle, whether it's lack of exercise, dietary, all the above, stress, lack of sleep, you know, all those kinds of things. And yet, you know, the faith community, tends to not want to address those kinds of things. It's glad to address, you know, other things, but it doesn't like to address those issues. And so, I say, look, you know, man, when you start talking about, for example, LGBTQ, these big thorny things, I mean, those are big thorny things, but my goodness, eating as if your body really matters, as if it really is the temple of the Holy Spirit, you know, eating like that, that's not all that hard. I mean, that's what you call picking the low-hanging fruit. Mm-hmm. You know, some of the other things can be really, really thorny, but this just eating clean. I mean, we think a lot more about the purity of the gasoline we put in our car than we do the fuel we put in our bodies, and that's just, you know, it's just silly. And I would suggest it's not being a good steward of our bodies.
Now, we're trending into really interesting territory for me. This is coming from my own angle, a little bit different direction, but I think it triangulates on the same spot. So here's what I think. Let me just toss this out, and then we'll let your reaction flow where it will, as it always does. So I've come to the conclusion, Joel, that we aren't going to elect, we're not going to program, we're not going to tweak or invent our way out of these various predicaments in which we find ourselves. And by the way, I would put obesity in there, right? I think that what's needed here is a shift in consciousness. Now, careful, I don't mean the groovy thing popularized and trivialized in the 60s. I mean we have to tame our egos, which are never content with what we have. They always, our egos want more. They're never satisfied. It's the thing that marketers play against, those hidden desires of ours, which are very rooted in our humanness and our egos, but it's in our subconscious. Man, they just target that stuff and they sell us the same stuff over and over again. And it's that they push easy buttons, right? So to lift out of that, to get to a place where we can be content and happy with what we have means we have to nudge that ego aside. And that right there creates the space for different thinking. I'm going to call that consciousness to emerge. So until we can be content with what nature can provide, we're just eating into the foundation of our existence. And I personally don't see a future unless we begin behaving entirely differently. And like you say, there's some low hanging fruit out there. We could begin our behavior sets with the low hanging fruit, not the really, you know, thorny, but you know, much higher fruit on that tree.
Right.
You know, how do you, what are your thoughts there?
Yeah, well, I think you're exactly right. I mean, in the epistles, Paul tells us, you know, I found wherever I am, to be content. And, you know, contentment is not possessions. Contentment is values, you know, way beyond just possessions. Many of the happiest people in the earth are we would consider, you know, in abject poverty, but they have. You go to some of these, for example, primitive cultures, and my goodness, their level of contentment is profound. They've got family. They don't have worries of whether the cell phone is working or not. I mean, we live in what I call a frenetic time, and you know, millennials are especially susceptible to this. I mean, their whole self-esteem and affirmation is based on how many likes they got. And boy, if I don't get a like in 30 minutes, oh no, the world has abandoned me.
Mm-hmm.
And we're growing an addiction to, you know, to a technological fix, and the freneticness of life. I mean, you know, young parents, if their kids aren't in 5 soccer leagues and 3 ballet programs, you know, they're not giving their kids a decent platform to life. And I would just suggest maybe the kids ought to be building some dams in the stream and some tree forts making their make believe, you know, we all know that little children, the toddlers, you know, you get them a present and they're done with it in about 5 minutes, and what they spend the day on is playing in the box. And so imagination is stimulated by making do and learning. You know, I've decided that the greatest wealth right now that a person can have is if you can grow something, build something, or fix something. If you can repair it, build it, or grow it, you know, that's who I want to be next to. Whether it's good times or bad times doesn't matter. And our culture right now does not stimulate that kind of thing. What it stimulates is you know, do you know the latest dysfunction in the Kardashian household?
Uh-huh.
what's the latest movie? What's the latest iPhone? What's the latest Snapchat? What's the latest thing that went viral on YouTube? I mean, I feel like we're levitating farther and farther away from the humus that is the foundation of human, this abdicating this ecological umbilical to our earthly womb, and as a result, we're de-learning, unlearning, whatever you want to call it. We're becoming more ignorant about how to actually practically live in our nest. And that's a dangerous place. If you can't live regeneratively in your nest, you're in a very vulnerable situation. Whether you're spending beyond your means, whether you're using technology that's fragile, way beyond your means, beyond your needs, whether you're eating food that you have no clue, where it came from, who had anything to do with it, what it was, you're putting faith in a lot of external stuff. And one of the things you learn pretty quickly in regenerative circles is that the resiliency and the stability comes from the inside out, not the outside in. And if we're not working on the inside out, in your book, the chapter on mastery is so profound. It takes time. It takes time to develop mastery, to grow things, repair things, and build things. And you're not going to get it out of a book when suddenly things go south. So yeah, I'm going on too long, but you see the point that that contentment and real value, real wealth, is not Wall Street portfolios and stuff. It's skill. It's mastery. It's knowledge. Those kinds of things. Knowing how to do things, fix things, and grow things. On our farm, it's interesting. We have gotten a lot of condemnation from the industrial food orthodoxy folks. That the way you farm, it takes too many people. Your kind of farming has too many people on the farms, and I say yes, it does take more people on the farm, but we have strategically chosen to substitute pharmaceutical intensity and dependency, capital intensity and dependency, and energy intensity and dependency with people. And when you do that, our equity as a farm business has moved from physical depreciable assets and ongoing expenditures. Our capital has moved to the non-physical skill, information, and customers of people. And there's not a bank in the world that can ever foreclose on your skill. Nobody is ever going to come to you and say, I'm going to repossess your knowledge. And so from an equity standpoint, when you move your equity from stuff to non-stuff, that becomes an extremely resilient wealth plan.
Mm-hmm. Indeed it does. And of course, you're just singing from the same hymn book as myself on this one, because this is also something that I judge is really sorely lacking in our culture at this point in time, where we're not really rewarding a real depth in certain things. So we reward some things, not others, And one of the key attributes that I'm looking at now is that of all the things we reward, if you open up a book and you say, well, what are masculine attributes? And we've got, assertiveness, dominance, reductionism, logic, all of that stuff. We got that in spades, but what we really don't make space for or honor or value is the other side, the feminine side of the equation, which is about relatedness and nurturing and being in the flow and maybe not knowing and being comfortable with the not knowing, all of that stuff, right? And so life is just a balance. And my prescription on all of this is, oh dear, we're way out of balance, right? And so you mentioned that at least in one very physical, tangible way, which is if you're living in a container and you're not doing it regeneratively, you are deeply exposed and it's going to come back and haunt you at some point in time. And the people who just both make me chuckle and get a little aggravated are the people like, oh yeah, we're going to Mars, right? Like this idea that, we have this functioning spaceship right now and we can't figure out how to work it right. So what we're going to do in a pinch is we're going to escape to another place. I'm like, that's cool, but you won't know why you broke the first thing and you're going to go do a second one. That's cool. How do you think the second one's going to work out, right? But it's just this fantasy delusion, which is that somehow I'll just go to this next circumstance and it'll be different that time. But if you don't understand why it was wrong in the first place, it's never different the second time. So it gets to that inside out part that you mentioned. Like, you know, I'll bring up like somebody, you know, if you've seen somebody and they're on their fifth divorce and but number six is the woman of his dreams, you know, you might go, you know, possibly, but maybe not, right? You might be carrying the same, you know, prescription and program to the next circumstance, and it'll turn out kind of the same as the last ones, because the way we really change this story is from the inside out. And I think if we rewind all the way to the beginning, like that's what you're really saying, is that with the marvelous pigness of pigs, you're really opening up a can of worms in a sense by saying, look, there's things here we can address, but they're not easy. And by the way, they require us to look inside, which feels like both a revolutionary, but a very old thought. You know, you can find such sentiments stretching back pretty far as the written word, I think.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. I mean, we say, well, you know, it's easy to say I can't. It's a lot harder to say I can. So, you know, I can't do this. I can't do this. Well, the reason it's so fun to say is because then we're not responsible. If you can do it, but you're not, then you're responsible. But if you can't do it and you're not, then you're not responsible anymore because you can't do it. And so, you know, I can't is a real enabler, you know, for things. And, you know, we see it here again, using the farm as metaphor. We see it here where, you know, we want to produce more, for example, from the farm, in order to generate more salaries so that more, you know, more people can be here. And so in order to do that, you know, most farms are always thinking, how do we gobble up additional farms, additional acres? And instead, for us, we're thinking, how can we stack? This is kind of a permaculture concept. How can we stack more enterprises here? So, for example, you know, we've dug a bunch of ponds, enough now that we've bought some this K-line irrigation system. So now when it gets dry in the summer, instead of sitting here and being depressed on the stoop because it's not raining, we take winter snow melt and early spring rains like we've had just lately. All the ponds are full now. And in August, we can dispense that water out on a landscape and we can grow another whole, you know, cycle of vegetation, you know, whether it's crops, grass, whatever it is, vegetables, we can grow another cycle of vegetation with that stored water. And so that's a way to work from the inside out to the outside in, instead of looking for, additional production from outside. Well, let's look inside and see what we can do. And we can grow, you know, we can grow other products, and we can do other things. I mean, we have a sawmill. So we got a sawmill so we could, you know, cut our own lumber. But guess what? You know, we can make furniture out of that lumber, and suddenly those trees that are worth, you know, $10 wholesale at the sawmill suddenly become worth, you know, $500 in a hutch or a chair or a table or whatever. And so suddenly, instead of having to, for example, harvest, you know, 50 acres of forest in order to make a decent income, we only have to harvest half an acre, and all the rest can keep growing, and we make the same amount off of half an acre that we did off of 50 acres. So that's the kind of inside-out thinking and stacking synergistic enterprises so that we actually generate more income on the same acreage, as opposed to always looking at more acreage.
And that more acreage, of course, is something that, you know, every time I visited a factory farm, if you will, I remember I visited one that was 11,000 acres down in Maryland. They had about 1% organic content left in this red clayish soil. And they couldn't figure out how they could possibly increase organic content, because they said, well, get it back up to 6%. That's about 3 years of fallow. And, you know, we're only making $150 an acre off of this stuff, which is pretty thin margin as it is. Given that this farm probably had flow throughs of millions of dollars, but their life and death depended on that $150 an acre of actual profit. and their experience was, I was like, well, how long has it been $150? And he's like, it's always $150. Like the price of corn goes up and all my inputs go up magically right under it, you know?
Yep. Mm-hmm.
And so that was sort of the treadmill that they were on, you know, one bad season and you're upside down in your loans and on and on. So I see how they really get trapped in that. But to untrap from that, which was, you know, I think I did that in my own life, creating my own job and figuring out what my gifts are and decoupling from being dependent on a paycheck. So these things have lots of metaphors and ways they can ripple through to people's lives. But, you know, if I could guess, you know, your magic in this is to just look at something and always have that curious question of saying, well, is there another way we could do this? What else can be done here?
Yeah, absolutely. As my son Daniel says all the time, he says our problem is not a lack of resources. We got plenty of resources.
Mm-hmm.
Our problem is constipation of imagination. that's our problem. You know, we're all blocked up because you know we know how it's supposed to be done or how other people think it's supposed to be done, That becomes our limiting factor, and the fact that we could do things very differently and profoundly better never even enters the imagination. I mean, that's what's so interesting about, for example, the work of Elon Musk at Tesla.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's a disruptor. You know, I mean, the disruptors are by definition these, you know, this lunatic fringe. I mean, take Airbnb. I mean, who would have thought 10 years ago that an outfit would be able to duplicate all of the bed space of Marriott, Hilton, and Sheraton combined without driving a nail or buying a mattress in 10 years?
Yep.
I mean, that's incredible. And so, you know, the whole sharing economy that's coming on, the sharing economy that's being enabled by, you know, by high-tech, you know, electronic means is part of that, you know, disruption of space. I mean, look what Uber has done to taxi drivers, for example. And the taxi drivers, of course, you know, they're rebelling and trying to circle the wagons and keep them all out, and you know, the hospitality industry is trying to keep out Airbnb and all this, you know, and it's, look, disruption happens and disruptors happen but disruptors are by definition, not very loved when they begin disrupting. Everybody's tickled at what, you know, Airbnb, for example, has done, whether you like it or whether you stay in them or not. Most people are amazed at what's happened, and it's a good thing. But you know, that's been a long slog, and people don't, for the guys who developed it against the grain, and you know, people love to talk about, oh, now they're multimillionaires, but what they don't like to talk about is the slog and
yep.
Mastery and actually breakthroughs are a slog. I mean, you're talking about you untrapped yourself from the life you were in and you started something different and did something different, but it was a slog. You know, it didn't just come handed in a silver platter.
Oh,
and
no.
Here's your income and here's your audience and here's your deal. And the same thing for me, you know, people love to talk about where we are now when we serve all these people. We got these in, you know, successful business, blah, blah, blah. But, you know, we had multiple years early on where, you know, we didn't grow it. We didn't eat it. We didn't go out to eat even 2 days in a year. And we never had a TV, still don't have one. And we drove a $50 car. And we lived on $300 a month, and you know, all of our friends were, you know, driving nice cars, but they had debt. We didn't have debt, and we leveraged that. And today, we enjoy what that early frugal living enabled us to do. And but it was a slog, you know, and you had to defy the marketing and the discontentedness. You know, we're back to that contentedness thing, and realize that our happiness was a vision. Happiness was a vision of profound resiliency and eliminating the vulnerability that most people had. And you know, it didn't happen overnight, but you know, we can step out the back door now and, you know, live from the garden and live from the community of people that we've developed here. And you know, it's good, but it came over, you know, 10 years and 10,000 hours, longer than that, but it came over time. And the slog is what stops people. And a lot of people want to unplug, untrap, and frankly, do better for themselves, do better for their ecology, mm-hmm. do better for their neighbor, for their community. Most people want to, but the frenetic life keeps you from making adjustments, and that's a real, you know, it's a real trap. You're right.
Well, it is a real trap, and I love everything you've just said there, because it just speaks to this idea that it's just doing the next thing. You know, you just got to get at it and get started. And there's no, I think part of the trap is thinking that there's a there, like I'll gain mastery and then I'll be a good farmer. It's like, no, you're going to be learning your whole life. And so if you don't enjoy the process of learning, it's very frustrating, I think, because there's no there. There's nowhere to get to. You know, one of my favorite quotes of all time is Pablo Casals, world famous cellist. He's 90 years old. The interviewer is asking him, hey, you still practice 3 hours a day. You know, you got it made. Like, you are the man. Like, why do you practice? And he, without missing a beat, he said, because I think I'm finally starting to notice some improvement. And he was serious, right? I mean, but he enjoys the process of becoming a better cellist over time. There was no there. He didn't achieve it, and then he's got it, and now he just brings that to the world. It's a constant process, right? And that's life, right? That is life. And I think our culture sold us short by saying that there's some sort of like attainment that happens, and then you're a celebrity, you're a Kardashian, and woohoo, you're now one of the most successful unhappy people we know, but at least you're successful or whatever, you know, that gets
killed. Well, and two, I think that this is whatever, exacerbated, if you will, by the fact that we're a culture of technicians. We honor technicians, IT, technology technicians that can put this together. And one of the critical aspects of being a technician of anything is that you have to follow a protocol. And, you know, you turn on your laptop and you can't turn it on if you say, well, today I think I'll turn this on by punching the letter C. You know, it doesn't turn on, right?
Yep.
And so procedural, roadmaps, procedural, just dotting all the I's and crossing all the T's has made us, I think, a culture of maybe should I say an overage or an overabundance of technicians, as opposed to prophets and disruptors. And because the technician follows the protocol, boom, 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 boom. And in fact, you know, you have to do it the same way every single day. You know, your computer doesn't like, you know, creative button pushing. You start being creative button pushing with your computer, and it's going to start blinking and doing funny things to you. And so we have gradually moved from, you know, we could even get, you know, wax all sorts of, you know, get into philosophical stuff about handwriting. You know, and it's interesting, all these studies that show now that your ability to remember something that you where you actually wrote down notes on a pad, say at a lecture, your cognitive your recall cognition is way higher if you actually tactically wrote it down on a yellow pad than if you typed it into a laptop. And there's a lot of work, brain work being done about these kinds of things. You know, it's interesting that the top CEOs in Silicon Valley don't let their kids play with iPhones and iPads because it gradually it affects your creativity, it affects your mental function, and so as we have moved into this technician culture, we reward technicians. And we marginalize profits, and not that profits, I suppose, have ever had a culture that loved them. But maybe I should not say profits. I should say poets. You know, the people are talking big picture and visionary stuff. We tend to kind of what kind of a wacko is that? You know, and we get back down in the weeds, get back down in the weeds with our technical stuff following protocol, and don't bother me with, you know, don't bother me with visions. You know, we're just gonna build more roads, and so we're gonna have more cars, and we're gonna use more fuel, and we're gonna, you know, we just kind of keep, you know, heading down the same path. And that's why people like Elon Musk, who dare to, Virgin Atlantic, who's the guy that owns Virgin Atlantic, you know, there's another disruptor, you know, people that think way outside the box. That's good stuff, and a culture needs those kind of people. In other times, they've been called, you know, heretics, people that today, for example, you know, if you dare to, you know, grow food without chemicals. I mean, that's a heretic faction, and yet it's the people who push that, the edge of the envelope, the ones that are the fringes of society that move a society forward, and how a culture responds to what's known as the lunatic fringe is the fine line between, you know, between tyranny and freedom. You know, the Romans had an axiom that you could tell the strength of a culture by how many laws it had. The more laws it has, the shakier the culture was. When a culture is virile and strong and confident, it doesn't care about weirdos. Sure, yeah, sure. You want to drink raw milk? Sure, go drink raw milk. You know. But when a culture becomes paranoid and fearful and timid and weak and fragile and shaky, that's when it starts making laws upon laws upon laws, because such a culture is too impotent to do anything really valuable. But they can write a lot of words and make a lot of laws, and I think there's a lot of truth to that concept.
I clearly this is part of the discussion that I don't think has gotten surfaced a lot. It does a little, which is that when you get something, you're often giving something up. And so technology's done some things for us. And you mentioned, okay, so the Silicon Valley executives, like, now, I'm not letting my kids play with that stuff, because they know what they've designed. And mm-hmm. Right. And so, yes, you know, we've all read the articles that say that, oh, people are losing the art of face-to-face communication, and they've gotten too many participation trophies, so they've lost the ability to manage defeat or criticism or critique, right, the things that you need, the failures you need to actually grow, because guess what? That's how we learn, by doing stuff, yeah, that didn't work out, right? All of that. And so it's clearly, you know, the Faustian bargain we've driven for ourselves in this, for me at least, is that when I look back through history and I see some of the astonishing things humans have done when they had the time, whether it was through boredom or we can access some new creative function with extra time or whatever happens, but there are things You know, if you just look at the Parthenon and how it's constructed, how it's nestled in, and each like it, the way it tricks the eye and you know draws you up and feels large without overwhelming. I mean, it's just an astonishing creation, right?
Sure.
And you know, absolutely. Somebody didn't just sit down and go, "Let's bang this out by Tuesday." You know,
right. Yeah, the cathedrals, the magnificent cathedrals of Europe. You know, that were 250 years in building. Talk about continuity. And yeah, and I don't want anybody listening to think that I'm an anti-technology. You know, that I hate technology. I mean, I'm glad that we're able to do a podcast, and through the internet, anybody in the world can access these words in a few seconds. I mean, that is a wonderful thing. But that's not everything. I think that this goes back then to the whole idea of Advent and the Sabbath. And one of the things, for example, that I've done for the last year or so, just as a you know, what can I do, is I've just made a convictional point to Sunday. I don't get on the internet at all. I don't look at emails. I don't look at anything. I just keep that computer off for one day a week. And you know, I find there's some positive stuff there of just unplugging for one day a week. And I mean, I'm sure there are people listening, oh, I can't imagine doing that. You know, my life would fall apart. But the stuff that we're talking about, I mean, yeah, it's a Faustian bargain. If you're going to, you know, embrace the technology, just realize it is a Faustian bargain. And in order to create, you know, human resiliency in your own physical, mental, spiritual, emotional condition, you have to appreciate that techno addiction is not a way to do that, actually militates against it. And so, you know, maybe unplugging on Sunday doesn't float your boat. Okay, well, so when are you going to? I mean, you know, they say that the sign of an addiction, right, is what happens when you don't have it. You know, people say, oh, I'm not an alcoholic. But when you say, all right, then I want you to not drink for 2 days, then that determines whether they're an alcoholic. And so, you know, a techno addiction, all I would say is, you know, when can you unplug? This year, interestingly, we have our interns now. We have 10 of them. And a new rule we made this year is we have a basket at supper. Everybody's cell phone goes in the basket, so nobody can be at dinner and be looking at their crotch and texting and all the things that the cell phone does. And it's been extremely good. You know, it's okay. So it's 1 hour a day, but just making a point of saying this isn't everything in life, and making a point to have that balance and to maintain your own personhood in this frenetic life, I think is a real valuable thing. And you'd be surprised what kind of conversations, what kind of thoughts you can have. It takes you a while to come down, to come down off of that frenetic thing, and answering those emails and looking at those YouTubes and, you know, following this down, following that down. Man, there's and the other thing that's happened, if you've read the works of Simon Sinek,
I have
lately. Okay, well, here's a guy, you know, one of the things that he points out is that it has made us very, very impatient. And when you talked about, you know, we're losing our ability to have face-to-face conversations, you're exactly right. I mean, Look at the kind of impatience people express on Facebook stuff that they would never say face to face or you know in a person's presence, and this translates into impatience with success, impatience with mastery, and Simon Sinek points out that a lot of these millennials are jumping from job to job to job every 6 months, because if they don't get promoted in 6 months, oh, I guess the company hates me, you know. I'm a failure here, and they go on to another one. And that's why I love, there's a new book that's coming out probably in August by the founder of Stockman Grass Farmer, who died in October, and his widow and business partner have taken his notes and are going to, it's going to be a legacy book. The title is the Family Business, and or Creating the Family Business, something like that. And he has just one, it's just going to be a wonderful book. And he uses this word throughout it, the slog. And he keeps pointing out that that a lot of what derails people is not an inability, not that they don't have the ability or the gift or the talent or whatever. It's the impatience of going through the slog. And we really see this now with, you know, when I was growing up, if something came up in the day, I said, oh, I want to read about that, research it. I had to wait till I came into the house in the evening, or maybe went to the library one evening a week and you know, get the encyclopedia, or, you know, look it up. And now, goodness, I'm out in the field and a little conversation comes up with an intern and, oh, I'm not sure about that. Next thing I know, here's the iPhone, you know, Googling, and everything is instant. Interestingly, I have a real good friend who's a pastor of a mega church, and we have a talk every month, just kind of a mastermind, little duo mastermind thing. And he was telling me that the number one, this might be a little bit off the reservation here, but that the number one user of Viagra now is not old men, it's young men between 20 and 28 who, because everything is internet and open and available now, they're having, you know, sexual function problems as a young man, because nothing matches the crazy fantasy, all the world that they're exposed to. It's this instant, you know, instead of growing into a life with a mate of satisfaction, contentment, and happiness with this monogamous relationship, it's this frenetic impatience from one thing to another to another to another, and it's fascinating, the ramifications of what frenetic impatience does to a life and to a culture and to a community that wants instant solutions, instant promotions, instant convenience. The average person now spends, I think the rule of thumb is fewer than 18 minutes in their kitchen a day. We're even impatient with our meals. You know, that if the hot pocket doesn't heat up in less than 30 seconds, you know, we're impatient. So the idea of planting a seed and watching the vegetables grow, and then dicing them and slicing them and canning them and taking an evening, creating our own domestic larder from culinary skill. When I say that, the pace sounds so slow, the average person says, "What? It's too much time." I might miss an ad on TV. You know, the idea of taking that time, and yet, you know, I would suggest that in the continuum of human history, those kinds of time spent have been the glue that holds families and relationships and civilizations and homes and communities, holds them together. The old, you know, the community hog killing, the threshing ring, the quilting bee, you know, it's amazing to me that, you know, all the civic clubs from, you know, Ruritan to JC's, Kiwanis, Rotary clubs, you know, they're all dying, because, you know, true community building takes time. It takes time, and we're too impatient for that time now. So what we want to do now, we can't go down here and build relationships with men and women that will man a little league, you know, concession stand with or anything. No, now I do my philanthropy through crowdfunding, and you know, something comes along. Sure, you know, I write my check. Okay, now my philanthropy's done. I can go on to my video game. The average American male right now, between 25 and 35 years old, spends 20 hours a week playing video games. The average American male, 25 to 35, spends 20 hours a week playing video games. When you think of what could be read, learned, incorporated into our lives with 20 hours a week during the most virile, high energy part of a man's life. Women don't do that. Women don't. Men do. That reflects a profound, squandering of value, wealth, life, and opportunity in our culture. It's profound.
Indeed it is. And of course, it's always profound talking with you, Joel, and we've run out of time, but I'm going to take this to heart. I've heard of a group of people I know where when they go out to dinner, everybody puts their cell phone on the table. And the rule is, if anybody really has to check their phone, they can, but the first person to touch their phone buys dinner for everyone. And if you can, wait it out through the whole dinner, you can split the check, right? You know, but if you can't, that's your choice, but you know, that's what they do. And, and so that's sort of a way to take it out of the farm and into the restaurant if you have to, you know, but,
sure.
But yeah, getting that, you know, to take some of the freneticness out and to build back towards mastery, back towards relatedness, back towards, you know, it just takes time. And that's one of the biggest things that I think in the Faustian bargain, that I think technology has promised to give us time, but it's stolen our time. And, you know, that's just really an astonishing thing when you look at it that way. So, with that, we're going to call it here, but tell people, do you have you mentioned a thing you're going to be talking at soon. What do you got coming up?
Well, I'll be in Burlington, Vermont, June 11 for the Mother Earth News Fair.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's a big deal going on in Bozeman, Montana, June 23 and 24. In fact, Robert Kiyosaki's going to be there. I'll be there. Lord Christopher Monckton will be there. It's going to be good.
That's the Red Pill Conference, I believe.
Yes, exactly. Okay, you got that. So, yeah, that's good. And, of course, Albany, Oregon, August 6th is another Mother Earth News Fair. If you've never been to one of those, you should go. I mean, you talk about everything out there in the art of do-it-yourself and sustainability. Mother Earth News Fairs are absolutely wonderful. And so there's a lot of stuff coming up, and it's going to be the best way to keep up with where I'm going to be is just to check our website, polyfacefarms.com, and my speaking schedule and itinerary is on there. And so if anybody wants to come and see me personally or hear something, be glad to see them at one of those events.
Well, fantastic. So we'll put the link to that down below. And if there's any way I can scoot up to Burlington just to say hi, I will do that, because that sounds like a lot of fun. So with that, Joel, thank you so much for your time today. Very generous and, of course, very wise and entertaining as always. Thank you.
Thank you, Chris. Wonderful to be with you. Take care.